The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Russians are due to head to the polls today for their country's presidential election. There is only one expected outcome, and many are seeing it as election in name only. With Alexei Navalny dead in unexplained circumstances and opposition candidates now barred from running, there is nobody remaining to pose any kind of serious obstacle to another 6 years of rule by Vladimir Putin. With me is Scott Lucas, who is professor of US politics at the Clinton Institute in UCD. Good morning, Scott.
Very good morning to you, Anton.
What, if anything, does Russia going to the polls mean, or is it just window dressing?
It's important window dressing for Vladimir Putin. It's important window dressing because, of course, it's the first presidential election since his invasion of Ukraine, his full invasion of Ukraine in 2022. He wants a high turnout to show legitimacy for that invasion. And, of course, as always with Putin, as he tries to run for a fifth term, he wants to show a high turnout as legitimacy for him. We know from the pattern of past elections that they will massage the returns so that he gets between 75-80% of the vote, and then you'll parcel out the rest amongst a few token challengers. The turnout in 2018 was about 67%, however, and that's the key. Will they be able to show a similar turnout this time? Will the turnout be lower than that? Will it be depressed? And could we possibly see a protest vote? Because the supporters of Alexei Navalny, the opposition politician who was effectively killed by the Kremlin last month, have said that they want people to show up at the polls at noon this weekend as a demonstration, with a mass turnout at that precise time, that not everybody is going to simply roll over and let Putin go unchallenged into his next 6 years.
Even doing that, I would imagine, is brave.
It's brave, but the hope from the Navalny supporters is if you get people who turn out in numbers. If you get a few people who turn out at a poll, then they can be picked up, they can be detained. If you get hundreds that suddenly show up, then you probably can't detain all of them. And it also looks bad. It looks bad to detain voters. Because they'll say, we're just here to cast our ballot, possibly for Mr. Putin. Why are you taking us away to prison? So I think the optics of it would look quite bad if that's what transpires and security forces are forced to react.
Does Putin actually need the turnout to be significant or healthy, or is that as massageable as the actual ballots?
You can massage turnout a bit. And in past elections, we've had stories, of ballot boxes being stuffed and all of a sudden, crates of ballots suddenly being shown up, from nowhere. And I think that could go on in the fringes. But, there's other signs of this. If you don't have long lines of people who turn out to vote, if you have, relatively empty polling stations, that's a sign of trouble. And even though there's been the Kremlin's clamped down on the media, and especially so in the last 2 years, they still have to have some coverage of the elections to make it look legitimate. And if you don't have people to show on screen, you got a problem.
Putin is very good at sending messages to people. And obviously what happened to Alexei Navalny will send a message to anybody who wants to stand in political opposition to him. Who, therefore, is willing to do it? And to what extent can they do it in any way that is impactful?
I mean, right now, you've got to say that the political space has really been shut down. There were two people who tried to come forward and run on a candidacy which challenged the Kremlin's policies and even challenged the invasion. But Yekaterina Dontsova, the journalist, she was disqualified in December by the Central Election Commission. And then when a man named Boris Nadezhdin, career politician, suddenly picked up a couple hundred thousand signatures, more than twice what was needed to actually get onto the ballot, he again was quickly barred on the grounds that, these signatures must be invalid. So I don't think we're talking about another Navalny at this point. We're not talking about a unifying figure. I think what you really have to look at is whether you have Russians at the grassroots who, in their very small but effective ways, begin to say, this isn't the way we want the country to be led. Not only we don't want the country to be led into what is now an endless invasion of Ukraine, but we don't want the country being led into what is going to be a series of economic problems in the next few years. And we don't want Russia being led into international isolation. And I think you're not going to get that in one mass movement, one mass sign of protest. It's going to be the small signs of protest. For example, almost every week there are a group of mothers and wives of Russian servicemen who've been mobilized on the Ukraine front line, who've been killed on the Ukraine front line, who pop up in Moscow at different places, including under the Kremlin walls, just to lay flowers. It's those types of shows that you're looking for. In other words, change will come from the bottom up, not from the top down.
To what extent do the Russian people have access to real information and to international media, or to what extent are they being spoon-fed from the Kremlin? Because that goes to how much of a grassroots movement can develop.
No, I mean, the Kremlin has got a lock on domestic media. Almost all independent media has been forced out of the country. You know, you talk about award-winning newspapers like Novaya Gazeta, which has been forced out of the country. You talk about Medusa, which has been forced out of the country. But even if, you know, you're really talking about an option of Russian state TV on Channel 1 and Russian state TV on Channel 2, there are some Russians who, of course, will, you know, through various means, get access to international media. You can't completely lock down the internet, and indeed the Kremlin doesn't try to. The problem here is that because a lot of Russians don't trust Russian state media, and they know they're being lied to there, they don't necessarily trust international media because they think all media is lying. So the real challenge, I think, is not that, you know, trying to get access by some Russians to international media, is trying to make sure that the information that they get, there's a dialogue there, there's some type of channel of discussion so that they put some type of faith in that information rather than have to take the Kremlin narrative or nothing at all.
Scott, can you put this in a sort of a longer time frame context for me? Because my layperson's understanding has been that from the Yeltsin-Putin transition, that there was a period of what appeared to be burgeoning democracy, and that we saw the kind of little bits of window dressing, like stepping from being prime minister to president. Then we saw presidential terms change. Then we saw control of media. It feels at this point that we are at the nadir of a process to completely erode and end democracy in Russia. Is that what has happened?
Yeah, I think you're talking about a transition really over the course of the last almost 25 years. So when Vladimir Putin, you know, emerged at the top, either as president or prime minister at the turn of the century, there was that hope continuing from the 1990s, which is that Russia could economically develop, that with economic development, of course, you get the opening up of political space and of social space. And there was a lot of international support to try to help Russia do that. But the problem is that the Russian economy had a whole series of problems. It had a whole series of internal problems. And it was also the fact that it continued to be controlled or was in the hands of a very small group of people, just as it had been during the communist years. And so when Russia didn't really get that economic takeoff in the 21st century, Putin began to see this not only in terms of, well, we can cooperate with the West. He began to go back to the idea of, we're going to have to make our own way. We've got economic problems here. We've got social tensions here. I'm going to turn it into us versus the West. And his real fear was, is that he wouldn't be able to win that, that you'd see the expansion of NATO. You'd see especially the expansion of the EU. That's part of the reason why he went to war with Georgia going all the way back to 2008. And what really spooked Putin, is when the president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, was forced from office by mass protest, not by NATO, not by the West, but by mass protest over Yanukovych's corruption, over his repression, and over the lack of political space. Yanukovych was Putin's guy. And when he went, the Kremlin panicked that Ukraine would go into NATO, would go into the EU, and they almost immediately seized Crimea and took part of eastern Ukraine. And when you carry out that type of aggression abroad, you match it with repression at home. We already know that Russia has clamped down on rights like LGBT rights, that they have clamped down on other social movements, that they've clamped down on freedom of information. But after 2014, it became essential to lock down the domestic space because Putin was making a big gamble, one that I think he's losing, but a decade-long gamble that he was going to expand his, quote, zone of safety into Eastern Europe.
Scott, thank you very much for that. That's Scott Lucas, who is professor of US politics at the Clinton Institute in UCD.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.